From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And looking in the rearview mirror, this was a big week. President Trump pulling out of a nuclear agreement with Iran, welcoming home American detainees from North Korea, and setting a date and location for an historic summit with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un about his nuclear weapons program. At a rally in Indiana last night, Trump claimed America is respected again.
We are all making America proud. We are rocking. We are rocking.
But it was also a week when questions continued to swirl about Trump's financial ties to his fixer, Michael Cohen, and a Trump staffer made a repugnant remark about Senator John McCain. Let's bring in our Friday roundtable. Joining us from opposite ends of Pennsylvania Avenue today, Chad Pergram, who covers Congress for Fox News. Hi, Chad.
Always good to be with you guys.
And Ayesha Rascoe, who covers the White House for NPR. Hi, Ayesha.
Hello.
So let's start with foreign policy, a big foreign policy week for President Trump, breaking with allies, pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal, bringing home those detained Americans from North Korea and setting that date and location, Singapore, for a historic summit. Chad, Trump supporters want him to win the Nobel Peace Prize.
Well, you know, I was struck by on the Iran deal how you had obviously Republicans didn't like this, but you had people like Ed Royce, the chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, indicating that, hey, this was a good move. You had Chuck Schumer, who opposed the deal in 2015, though, saying that this was the wrong move. He said Iran hasn't broken any of the strictures of the deal. And so he thought that this was a mistake, saying there's nothing to back it up. And one of the issues that we put to lawmakers here, Mitch McConnell, the majority leader, hinted at maybe there would have to be some legislation. There was a legislative framework that was developed for the Iran deal. It was not handled as a treaty, as under the Constitution, where you need two-thirds, and maybe they have to put something in place. That was something that Chuck Schumer was critical of, saying there's nothing there. And some other senators from both parties said maybe we do need legislation, because if President Trump leaves and he wants the Iran deal to stay in this status, you know, the idea that it's off, you know, we're going to go, drum up a new agreement with them or nothing at all. He said, you know, there's nothing that binds any other administration to this.
Well, and Ayesha, I want you to bring you in, because what about this feeling that this was a huge week, at least for Donald Trump and his supporters? I mean, people may debate what's going to happen because of the pullout from the Iran deal, but certainly it was a huge week for him with his base.
It definitely was, and it was a week that President Trump can point to where he really, if he hadn't already, really took charge of foreign policy and was making decisions that are going to have long-lasting impact. So he kept his promise. He had said that he was going to dismantle the Iran nuclear deal, and by pulling out and reimposing sanctions, he took a major step towards that. And then when it comes to North Korea, he setting this meeting, setting the time and place, getting these detainees back, that is something that makes President Trump look like a statesman,
Sure. Looks
like a diplomat and someone who is getting things done.
Yeah, and it was a big week in the sense that the president got the Senate nominee that he wanted in West Virginia. He didn't want Don Blankenship.
Right.
That was the one thing for sure that he didn't want.
And he said so.
Against Joe Manchin. Yeah. As we speak, he is meeting with auto executives at the White House, and central to that conversation is maybe withdrawing from NAFTA and dealing with making more cars in the United States. And then, as you mentioned, there were the foreign policy issues. So this was a pretty successful week.
Yeah, but as we look up at the TV channels, at the cable news, all we're seeing is John McCain's daughter talking about the comments that came out. And it just, this does seem to be a pattern with this White House, that there might be accomplishments, but they are then wiped out by something like Kelly Sadler, who's the White House staffer, who, and she's an aide to Chief of Staff John Kelly, who made that comment in a staff meeting yesterday after John McCain criticized Trump's pick to lead the CIA. This is Gina Haspel, who's been having these hearings. She has not called torture immoral in her confirmation hearing. He, of course, was tortured, said he wouldn't vote for her. Kelly Sadler, the White House staffer, said his vote doesn't matter because he's dying anyway. And here's McCain's daughter, Meghan McCain, responding this morning on ABC's The View.
Whatever you want to say in this kind of environment, the thing that surprises me most is I don't understand what kind of environment you're working in when that would be acceptable, and then you can come to work the next day and still have a job.
Yeah.
And that's all I have to say about it.
Chad Pergram, how is it that Kelly Sadler still has her job and the White House has not issued any kind of apology?
Well, you know, this is the argument that President Trump has had with John McCain. You know, he kind of touched this off several years ago, saying that, you know, he liked people who weren't captured. And the fact that, you know, there have been other missteps, intemperate language said on Capitol Hill,
said by the White House.
And I'm surprised. Yeah. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, so are you saying the fish rots from the head, which is what people are saying, that comments like this are made because of the president?
And at the end of the day, you know, this comes amid the initiative by Melania Trump, you know, talking to children about being
be best
on social media. Those two things fly in the face of one another. I would also point out that it's very interesting that there has been no conversation here on Capitol Hill, not a single statement that I've seen from any member of Congress upbraiding the White House or defending John McCain since that statement was released last night. And the other thing I would note is that it's amazing that John McCain has not voted since early December. He hasn't been in Washington since then, and he has cast such a long shadow. This influential statement that he put out the other night saying he wouldn't vote for Gina Haspel based on her record dealing with interrogation methods, the fact that other senators have said that they will consider that as they weigh their vote, and the fact that this has come up now, you know, with Kelly Southern at the White House. It's amazing just the influence that John McCain has when he's not here.
Mm. Well, John McCain's wife, Cindy McCain, responded to Sadler's comments on Twitter and also to an interview that happened on Fox Business yesterday. Former Fox News military analyst Thomas McInerney said this about Haspel and torture yesterday.
Well, she can't use it anymore because we've determined the Congress that it's not legal. The fact is John McCain, it worked on John. That's why they call him Songbird John.
Oh,
now, the host of that segment, Fox Business host Charles Payne, apologized. He said he didn't hear McInerney. But Aisha, this goes back years within the GOP, this... But they have a problem with John McCain.
Well, and by the way, this is not true. The reason he was in prison for so long is that he didn't sing. Who wants to take that?
Well, I think that this issue for the White House certainly at this point is a distraction. And I do think, although this White House has a policy almost not to apologize for anything, I think that this is a point where maybe— they will have to kind of take a step back and actually own this and do something about it. I'm not sure. We'll see what happens. But it just seems like at this point, when you have someone who is sick, why have this hanging over what was otherwise a positive week for this White House?
And we will see next week. President Trump, I have confirmed since we have been on the air, is going to come here on Tuesday and meet with Senate Republicans. They usually have their usual Republican lunch here on Capitol Hill next Tuesday. And we've confirmed that President Trump is going to come up here, and we'll see if this is an issue that's still lingering come next Tuesday.
Huh. Anything else you hear, Chad, by the way?
Just feel free to bring it up.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Let's talk about Michael Cohen, by the way. Today, the CEO of AT&T said it was a big mistake to hire Trump fixer Michael Cohen as a political consultant, but insists the company did nothing illegal. Yesterday, Novartis' CEO said the same thing. This was money that Cohen put into the same company that he used to pay porn star Stormy Daniels to keep quiet about an alleged affair with President Trump. He also accepted money from a company connected to a Russian oligarch. Aisha, is this how business is done in Washington, or where do you see this going?
For me, I didn't know this was the way business was done. We know about lobbyists, but Michael Cohen wasn't a lobbyist, and he, as far as we know, doesn't have any policy experience or even really much political experience. But he did have a connection to the president and apparently was getting money from companies because of that. And we don't really know exactly what he was offering or what they expected to get from him. It doesn't appear that at this point that anything that was done was illegal. But just politically, when you have a president who said he was going to drain the swamp, coming in and having someone, his longtime personal attorney, accepting money from companies, that does seem to run counter to this idea that you're dealing with corruption. Yeah. And I think that usually one thing that Americans don't like about politics is this idea of pay to play.
Right.
And this is a perfect example of pay to play.
Well, look, we just got about a minute and a half, and so I want to ask about Republican commentators. In George Will's comments this week about the president and the vice president, he wrote an op-ed piece concluding with, "Trump is what he is, a floundering, inarticulate jumble of gnawing insecurities and not at all compensating vanities, which is pathetic. Pence is what he has chosen to be, which is horrifying because of his obsequiousness." Chad, what does this reflect about the Republican Party?
Well, you know, the Republican Party started to drift away from those core Reagan values that we often heard so much about a long time ago. And this stems back to the shadow of John McCain. He picked Sarah Palin as his vice presidential running mate in 2008. And a lot of the energy that was composed in the Tea Party that has, you know, drifted over into the energy that is surrounded with President Trump, it goes back to that. I mean, Sarah Palin was kind of the person, you know, who gave rise to and said oftentimes intemperate things. I mean, this there is a connection here in that regard.
You're so right. It started there, the two halves that could not fit together. That's Chad Pergram, Capitol Hill senior producer for Fox News. Ayesha Rascoe, White House reporter for NPR. Thank you, both of you, for this look back at this incredible week. Thank you.
Anytime.
Thank you.
A report published in the Journal of the American Medical Association last week finds that synthetic opioids such as fentanyl have for the first time surpassed prescription opioid pills such as oxycodone as the source of opioid overdose-related deaths. This is no surprise to our next guest, who's on the front lines of the opioid addiction crisis. Dr. Rahul Gupta is health commissioner of West Virginia, which has the highest rate of opioid-related deaths per capita in the U.S. Last year, Dr. Gupta was named West Virginian of the Year by the Charleston Gazette-Mail for his efforts to fight the addiction crisis. And he did something that no other state health commissioner has done. He crunched the numbers, studying every single one of the state's 887 opioid-related deaths in 2016 to better understand how to address the crisis. And Dr. Gupta, why do this? What questions did you have in mind?
One of the things we wanted to find out is learn from those who have already passed away. And how can we learn just not about the medical diagnosis or what's found in their blood, but actually also find out what were their social conditions like? What would a social autopsy of someone who dies from a drug overdose look like? For example, we found about 71% of the decedents actually had Medicaid, yet we found that there was less likelihood of getting naloxone, which is an antidote for reversing overdose in the field, if EMS was called.
Medicaid for the poor, the elderly. So you're saying that when there was a call for a poor or elderly overdose victim, they were less likely to get the life-saving medication that can reverse that because, what, maybe there was a bias against the poor and elderly?
Well, what we're saying is that stigma issues run wide and probably deeper than we actually estimate to be.
So there's that. And another finding, men were twice more likely to die of an overdose than women. Tell us more.
Sure. One of the things we found with regards to men of a certain age, which is 35 to 54 years old, we also found if you were high school educated or less, and if you were single, working in a blue-collar industry, that's when you have the highest risk. And part of it's because we also found that over half of all decedents had been previously incarcerated as well. So these are all those risk factors. And when you ask about particularly men, I think a lot of that has to do both the workforce, the type of industry, the high risk of injury in the industry, and which leads to people getting prescribed for drugs such as opioids, and then finally developing that opioid use disorder and whether they transition on to heroin or fentanyl. These are the risk factors.
Well, so what do you do with this information? We know it starts with trying to get the state to respond with legislation, and they have requiring all first responders to carry naloxone, that injection we talked about that reverses overdoses. In one case, a law limiting pain prescriptions to 7 days, for example, so that people have to continually go back to a doctor and there won't be this sense of maybe being overprescribed medication.
We also found, by the way, that decedents were three times more likely to have died if they had three or more prescribers. Similarly, they were more than 70 times likely to have prescriptions at four or more pharmacies. So one of the things we're also doing is we're developing more robust data collection systems to make sure that we're monitoring through the state's prescription drug monitoring program the prescriptions, so there is no duplications, and we're limiting the number of pharmacies that people can get medications like opioids filled, so that that will relate to and lead to fewer overdoses and fewer deaths eventually.
Well, because we want to remind people, we've reported on this. West Virginia had, you know, a serious cases of pill dumping. Congress looked into this and found that drug manufacturers had shipped 20 million prescription painkillers to just two pharmacies in Williamson, Virginia, the town that only has like 3,000 people. So there were a lot of pills being churned out. What do you do about the finding that 4 out of 5 West Virginians who died from an overdose in 2016 had come into contact with the health system? And you talked about, you know, emergency responders responding to an overdose and maybe not bringing the life-saving reversal. That might be one contact. But they'd also gone to emergency rooms or gone to a clinic for a routine checkup and still overdosed. What do you make of that?
So I think that's a very important question. In fact, that was one of the most critical findings. What that shows is that there are missed opportunities within our systems. And sometimes we may get just single opportunity when somebody comes to visit a physician or another provider in a clinic to get help. It was us as the healthcare system who failed these individuals.
Well, you've set up a county-based quick response team so people who repeatedly overdose don't just walk away after being revived. They can get some help. But you yourself treat patients once a month at a charity clinic in Charleston. How does that, first of all, impact your view of this? And what do you take away from that?
Just a couple of weeks ago, I was able to see about 9 patients, 4 of which actually had substance use disorder. And 2 of those, that particular day, I was able to refer to medication-assisted treatment and get them the help. But the other 2 that day really were not willing to go to into treatment. At that point, you have to continue to offer appropriate guidance and counseling to individuals and support with the hope that when they come back next time, they'll be ready. So it's having that experience on the ground, talking to individuals who are suffering from substance use disorder. I think it's important for someone like me making policy that it helps me remain grounded as to the real individuals and humans that we're impacting the lives of by changing those policies.
Well, some of the policies that have been changed in your state, primary care doctors who aren't licensed for substance use treatment are now allowed to administer the drugs that can help people go through withdrawal. The state won a federal waiver to allow Medicaid to pay for inpatient substance abuse treatment at some facilities. Again, you found 71% of those who died had or were eligible for Medicaid coverage. But if Medicaid doesn't cover treatment, then, you know, they're not helped there. So there's a waiver there. What more still has to happen?
Well, so you're correct that we were able to not only through a waiver get a ability to fund those facilities, but fund for naloxone to be reimbursed, but also warm handoff.
That warm handoff. Is that what you said? Warm handoff?
Correct. Warm handoff. So
yeah.
Not only do providers get reimbursed for administering naloxone, but they also get additional fee for being able to do a warm handoff to other agencies that actually may enter those individuals to treatment. And in primary care practice, especially in a rural state like West Virginia, people may not have readily access to medication-assisted treatment. They may have to travel many, many miles to get there. So one of the things we wanted to create is an exemption for those primary care to be able to provide medication-assisted treatment to their patients if they feel they wanted to do so. So we've been able to do that as well. To the question of what still needs to happen, I think one of the aspects is that this is a epidemic of so many different epidemics. Just addressing a particular substance of use or misuse isn't enough.
Do you think you're – I mean, it's so vicious. Do you think you're making a dent?
I think we're certainly making progress. Challenges continue and the epidemic continues to evolve. But I certainly think it's important to learn first from a data and analytical standpoint and then be able to transform that into policy, but also then step back and look at the larger picture as to what are those pieces missing in our society. How do we develop hope into communities and be able to inspire those communities to actually you know, move from the diseases of despair and desolation to one where people are more optimistic about their community, their neighborhoods, their families.
Well, for instance, there's a town in West Virginia, Huntington, which is seen as sort of the epicenter of this. Probably a lot of blue-collar workers, probably a lot of construction jobs, probably a lot of people, you know, below the poverty line on Medicaid. What are you saying? Break up that town, or, you know, target that town, move a health official into that town? What are you saying?
Yeah. So here's an analogy. In this country, if you get hit by a car, we're very good in helping you survive, getting you to the best trauma surgeons, the neurosurgeons, and getting you that care. But if you have diabetes as a result or previously existing, we're not very good at managing that diabetes and preventing a stroke or a heart attack from happening long term. So I think we're going to be making progress in the ability to make gains in terms of overdose deaths and address some of the immediate aspects of this crisis. But when it comes to the long-term impact, as how do we turn our communities into ones that are more integrated, that are looking at issues of workforce, education, air, water, food establishments, I think that's going to be a bigger task to happen, and that still needs to happen.
Well, Dr. Gupta, we wish you the best of luck. Dr. Rahul Gupta, Health Commissioner of West Virginia, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Today, President Trump is announcing a plan to lower prescription drug prices and reduce out-of-pocket costs for patients. This is an issue Trump has been talking about since his campaign. And joining us now is Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
So during his campaign for president, Trump called for the government to negotiate Medicare drug prices. Here he is speaking at a rally in New Hampshire in February 2016.
We're not allowed to negotiate drug prices. Can you believe it? So we buy drugs, biggest in the world, and we pay about $300 billion more than we're supposed to if we negotiated the price.
But today he's not calling for the government to negotiate prices now. Why not?
Well, you know, I haven't heard an explicit explanation for why not, but realistically, it may have been a very difficult thing to pull off politically because it's very much a Democratic type of idea rather than a Republican. And the way it works now is that prescription benefits under Medicare are actually handled by private companies that are under contract with the government. And it's these companies that do the negotiating of drug prices. There's actually a law in place that says the government can't get involved in these negotiations. But even though Trump had campaigned on the idea of having the government negotiate, it's again, something that would be very difficult to pull off politically with a Republican Congress. And the plan instead is going to try to make it easier for these middlemen companies to do better negotiating themselves.
Now, there's currently a system of rebates that insurers and pharmacy benefit managers negotiate with drug companies. Trump does want to change that system. How does he want to do that, and how will that make drugs cheaper?
Yeah, Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar has said he wants to reexamine the legal protections in place that allow for these rebates. And there is a lot of criticism of the system, mainly because some of the rebates are actually passed on to consumers. But in some cases, the insurers and the pharmacy benefit managers actually keep most of the rebates or redistribute them. The drug industry has actually put the blame on these middlemen for a big reason why prescription prices are so high, because of these pharmacy benefit managers are keeping the rebates. So there's a lot of finger pointing going on throughout the whole supply chain of the pharmaceutical industry.
Well, another part of this that Trump is expected to talk about today is generic drugs. The FDA approved a record number of generic drugs last year. Trump wants that approval process to be sped up even further.
Right. Part of his budget request, in fact, even before this to Congress, he proposed speeding up generic drug approvals. Currently, the way it works is the first company to try to bring a generic drug to market gets 6 months to sell the drug before other competitors can come in and drive down the price. Now, if that company has trouble making the generic or has trouble getting it approved, the whole process can drag out. And that makes consumers wait longer for the less expensive generic version. So the proposal would allow the FDA to leapfrog these troubled applications and move on to one that is closer and ready to gain approval.
Are consumers going to notice any changes from this just in the few seconds we have?
can you ask me that again in a year or so? There's so many moving parts, it's hard to say exactly.
That's Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
They say Tannoy for public address systems, Biros for ballpoint pens. We say mom, apartment, elevator. They say mum, flat, lift. They end words like theater with R-E. Why? It's not theatra. They put U's in everything. Does color need a U? They are the English. We are Americans. The twain do not meet, as linguist and language blogger Lynn Murphy lays out in her new scholarly book, The Prodigal Tongue, The Love-Hate Relationship Between American and British English. Lynn was born in the U.S., married a Brit, now teaches at the University of Sussex, and joins us from the BBC studios in Brighton. Welcome.
Thank you.
And, you know, I was displaying kind of mock indignation at the differences in the language. I actually never think about British English, but you say the Brits are apoplectic about American words invading their language. Prince Charles has railed against it. It kind of set the scene for us. How are people in Britain talking about American English?
Well, you know, it is certain British people. But there's a general fear of American English coming and taking over from British English. And so when new American words appear, when British people order things in coffee shops saying, can I get a latte or something like that, people get upset because it sounds like they're not as British anymore.
Well, let's explain that, can I get a latte? You talk about tone and the fact that the British say please and thank you all the time. You set up a scene in a bus where a bus driver opens the door, pulls up and says, thank you. The person getting on says, thank you. The bus driver says, thank you for your ticket. They give a ticket and they say, thank you, four times. And when you order something, if you don't say please, how does that hit the British ear?
It sounds like you're bossing them around. And what's kind of funny is that Americans tend to have the opposite reaction, that if you say please, it sounds more urgent. And so it might be a bit more like being bossy, you know, saying do it now. So Americans say please half as much as British people do.
Well, back to the fear of American English invading British English. What are some of the words that have maybe recently come across?
British people worry about the word cookie has come over, the word French fries or just fries has come over. A lot of things to do with eating and food, because American food has become very trendy lately. But people worry about those words replacing good old British words. So, you know, that they'll now say cookie instead of biscuit. That's not always what happens. Often the new words carve out their own little place in the British ecosystem.
Or the words that Brits think are Americanisms are not.
Yeah, often that's the case. So something like sidewalk, which the British usually say pavement, closet, where the British would say cupboard or wardrobe. Those things came over to America with the settlers, and then they were forgotten back in Britain. And now when they're heard in Britain, people think, oh, it's those American words coming over. But really, it's just, you know, the old words coming home.
Boomeranging. Bumbershoot for umbrella.
is not a British word, but it gets represented as a British word in a lot of American representations of Britishness. So in the film Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, they're saying the word bumbershoot as if it's a British word, but it's not. It was Yale College slang in the 1920s, 30s, and somehow people started assuming it was an English word because it was unfamiliar and it had to do with rain.
Well, and because it's kind of cute. And,
yes.
And Americans, you point out, tend to think, oh, those Brits, you know, they say things like lovely jubbly and mad as a box of frogs. But you point out Americans say lickety split and discombobulate and hootenanny. I mean, we have our own.
We've all got fun words. But among Americans, there tends to be this feeling like British words are a bit puzzling and silly. Whereas in Britain, the stereotypes of American words tend to be more that they are redundant or a bit incorrect.
Well, this goes all the way back to the fact that we fought a war and we separated from the motherland. Noah Webster, who wrote that Britain's linguistic preferences were not to be emulated because the taste of her writers is already corrupted, her language is on the decline. And he was part of a move to discourage the new Americans from adopting certain kinds of British English.
Yeah, so he didn't want us to keep on trying to sound like aristocrats, you know. So in Britain, it's always been the language of the upper classes that's been emulated. And in America, we were supposedly getting rid of that sort of aristocratic class. And therefore, we needed a new way to speak that wasn't sort of bowing down to that part of society. He also felt like we needed to be united, and so we should try to get rid of the differences that we had because people came from different parts of England or were developing different ways of speaking in different parts of the country. So he also was looking to standardize what Americans did.
What were some of the words that he instructed people not to say?
He was very concerned with the spelling system. So he was trying to get us to use spellings like color without the U, or theater with an E-R rather than an R-E. But he went even further than that. He wanted us to spell is as I-Z and tongue as T-U-N-G. So a lot of the changes that he wanted to make happen, he didn't make happen. But still in England at that point, people were arguing whether color should have a U or not. And so Americans went one way and Britain went the other.
I'm sorry, but that's the one that just bothers me the most. But again, the Brits hold on to it because, as you explain, you speak the way the people around you speak and you want to hold on to the ways that you have spoken.
Yeah, your language is a link to the generation before you and the generation before that.
And yet, you'd think that there'd be even more erasing of the differences because everyone's on the internet.
You'd think so. But part of what's happening is that people are trying to put out their own identity. And so if you're spelling on the internet, the way that you can show what country you're from is to spell a certain way. We've seen in the last sort of 30 years an increase in British people spelling words like realize with an S instead of a Z. That was always something you could do in British English, but it wasn't something you had to do. And now that they're interacting with Americans more and more British people are seeing the S as something they have to do in order to show their Britishness.
Here's some more of the differences. Americans speak of Kleenex, Band-Aids, Styrofoam. The British generally call them tissues, plasters for Band-Aids, polystyrene for Styrofoam. Britons play sport, not sports. They pay tax, not taxes. They get toothache, not toothaches. We actually have a difference on the way we say math. Brits say maths. With an S, not
yes.
Math. What's that like for you as an American? You've been living there a while, married to an Englishman. You have a child. Are you still brought up by saying something or hearing something that is unfamiliar?
Well, I hear things that are unfamiliar all the time. You know, every time I go to an administrative meeting at the university, someone will use some cliche I've not heard before. So I'm always noting things down, learning new things. But at the same time, because I do live in this culture, because I want to be understood, and because I don't want to be made fun of every time I open my mouth, I say maths. I say herbal rather than herbal. My vowels have shifted a bit. I say my T's more sharply. And that's all because of living in it.
Yeah. Well, we can't let you go without addressing schedule. just the history of the word, why it's schedule and schedule.
Yeah, the word was originally sedule, and then for some reason people started spelling it differently in the 18th century. And so it was spelt as we spell it now for a while before anyone knew how to pronounce it. And so people debated, should it be like this SCH in school, or should it be like the French were pronouncing it in schedule? And Americans went one way and the British went another way.
Linguist Lynn Murphy, her blog, Separated by a Common Language, her book, The Prodigal Tongue, The Love-Hate Relationship Between American and British English. And if you want to know how heated it can get, here's just two examples she gives us on Twitter. At British Logic proclaims, people who spell color without the U don't deserve to live. You also quote Homer Simpson as saying, English, why would I ever want English? I'm never going to England. It's just great. Lynn, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, Lynn spoke of the British thinking sidewalk is an American word. Here's English comedian Michael McIntyre on a talk show explaining it's basically because Americans are, well, stupid.
So they've taken the English language, but they've looked at some of it and they thought, no, I think we need a little bit more explanation here. Okay? That's my American accent. So things like pavement. So they can't work with pavement, so they've changed it to sidewalk. Yeah. They needed more information. They needed to know where they were going to be walking so that they wouldn't get run over.
Ha! Mike, we have the last laugh because we have Lynn Murphy, who just explained sidewalk started in Britain. To see that full video and an excerpt from Lynn's book, or to join the linguistic smackdown with your own pet peeves, go to hereandnow.org.
Republican Senator John McCain is urging his colleagues to reject President Trump's nominee to be the next director of the CIA. In a statement released Wednesday, Senator McCain said Gina Haspel's refusal to acknowledge torture's immorality is disqualifying. At least one Democrat, Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, has said he'll support Haspel's nomination. We want to spend a few minutes now listening to some extended clips of Haspel's nomination hearing before the Senate Intelligence Committee from Wednesday, starting with Democrat Martin Heinrich of New Mexico, who asked Haspel about the CIA's so-called enhanced interrogation techniques.
Were these the right thing to do? Are they consistent with American values, fundamentally? What do you believe?
Senator, I believe very strongly in American values and America being an example to the rest of the world. That is why I support the fact that we have chosen to hold ourselves to a stricter moral standard.
But that's about Congress and all of us. I want to know what you think.
I think that we should hold ourselves to a stricter moral standard, and I would never allow CIA to be involved in coercive interrogations.
Where was that moral compass at the time?
Senator, that was 17 years ago, and it's, you know, CIA, like the U.S. Army and the U.S. Marine Corps, is an organization. It's a large bureaucracy, and when you're out in the trenches at far-flung outposts in the globe, and Washington says, here's what we need you to do, this is legal, the Attorney General has deemed it so, the President of the United States is counting on you to prevent another attack.
It's legal.
I'm sorry?
I know you believed it was legal. I want to trust that you have the moral compass that you said you have. You're giving very legalistic answers to very fundamentally moral questions.
Senator, we've provided the committee every evaluation since my training report when I first joined in 1985. In all of my assignments, I have conducted myself honorably and in accordance with U.S. law. My parents raised me right. I know the difference between right and wrong.
Republican Susan Collins of Maine pushed Haspel on her assertion that the CIA's so-called enhanced interrogation program was in the past.
As a candidate, President Trump repeatedly expressed his support for waterboarding. In fact, he said we should go beyond waterboarding. So if the CIA has a high-value terrorism suspect in its custody, and the president gave you a direct order to waterboard that suspect, what would you do?
Senator, I would advise, I do not believe the president would ask me to do that. We have today in the U.S. government other U.S. government entities that conduct interrogations. DOD uses the Army Field Manual, and they conduct battlefield interrogations. And CIA has incredible expertise it can bring to the table in support of those interrogations. The FBI has its authorities to conduct interrogations. And as you know, we have the high-value interrogation group. So, you know, I would be advise anyone who asks me about it that CIA is not the right place to conduct interrogations. We don't have interrogators, and we don't have interrogation expertise. So I believe that that would be my – the reason I have been nominated is that people have some respect for my views on these issues. My experiences during those days after 9/11 inform my views. I'm extremely knowledgeable, and I'm also extremely knowledgeable about the price CIA – working level men and women out in the trenches paid for decisions made after 9/11.
Democrat Dianne Feinstein of California questioned Haspel about her role in the destruction of dozens of videotapes made at a CIA black site where prisoners were waterboarded.
Were you an advocate for destroying the tapes?
Senator, I absolutely was an advocate if we could within and conforming to U.S. law, and if we could get policy concurrence to eliminate the security risk posed to our officers by those tapes and the consistent legal advice.
And you were aware of what those tapes contained?
No, I never watched the tapes, but I understood that our officers' faces were on them and that that was very dangerous at a time when there were unauthorized disclosures that were exposing the program.
But it also exposed how the program was conducted, because they were tapes of the actual interrogation of certain of 92 detainees, as I understand it.
No, the tapes were recordings of only one detainee. It was 92 tapes of one detainee.
All right. Well, thank you for that.
Gina Haspel testifying before the Senate Intelligence Committee on Wednesday. She's President Trump's nominee to be the next CIA director. A full Senate vote on Haspel's nomination is expected in the coming weeks. Robin, it's nice in a world of sound bites to be able to listen a little longer to some of the news, especially in a busy week like this with so many stories going on, to listen a little longer to some of those clips. Here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.